to the Lemper Report Live. Today, it's all about soil, how food delivery has changed the country, a new initiative out of Philadelphia that promotes healthy foods, the food transport problem, lots and lots and lots on the metaverse from standards to home remodeling, a chat with Wesley Rhodes of Kroger, and we ask, why not add a healthy food tax? Let's get started. Sally, tell me about the soil shortage that we have.
Phil, we're hearing from a new report that the impact of soil degradation could total in $23 trillion in losses of food by 2050. Now, just to put into perspective, I thought this was a really interesting quote and way of describing how important soil is. Reza Afshar, chief scientist at the Regenerative Agriculture Research Farm at the Rodale Institute, told CNBC that soil is the habitat for over a quarter of the planet's biodiversity. Each gram of soil contains millions of cells of bacteria and fungi that play a very important role in all ecosystem services. So this soil is a major part of sustaining life. And they've identified 10 soil threats in this global report. And the number one is soil erosion, which is taking place everywhere.
Yeah, and also it's so important to realize that soil is a key factor in mitigating climate change. Soil contains more than three times the amount of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere and four times as much in all living plants and animals combined. Also, this scientist from Rodale, let's not forget that Rodale really started the whole organic farming movement in this country, and they're still at it, and good for them. There's a new report from the Brookings Institute that talks about data that reveals the geography of digital access in food in the U.S. One-third of all U.S. adults have used delivery apps to order from a restaurant or store in the past year. We know that it continues to go up. So what they did is they took Amazon Fresh, Whole Foods, Instacart, Uber Eats, and Walmart data. Each of these companies, each of these organizations worked with them to really map it out so we could get a handle of what percentage of the U.S. Is covered by these delivery services. And top line, 93% of America's population has access to rapidly delivered fresh groceries or prepared foods through at least one of the four platforms. Number one area is the New York metro area. Number two is Los Angeles, Long Beach. Three, Chicago, Naperville. Four, Dallas, Fort Worth. And five is Houston. The list goes on. But when I read this, you know, what they really want to do is they really want to talk about how food access for those people in food deserts can be improved. And this shows that it can be improved. But an idea came to me. What they point out is that even with all this access, even with the fact that a lot of people who are on SNAP have mobile devices, there's still about 17 million of people that do not. And what came to me, and I'd love your opinion of this, is if I was Amazon, I would go into these areas and I would put a food kiosk, you know, but something that somebody couldn't steal, you know, a touch screen. So it would allow people in these food deserts that don't have access to be able to order from Amazon, Amazon Fresh, Whole Foods, and they would instantly have another 17 million customers. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. You know, they have the, you know, they have these Amazon delivery stations now. You know, we've got one right down the street at the at a convenience store. So this definitely seems like something that that could happen. It's really amazing to me what we can do with technology. And, you know, what we were talking about last week about how Uber is helping get food aid to these really hard to get areas in the Ukraine. So if we can do that, then these 17 million people that are here in the U.S. that don't have access, it seems like we can figure out a way to get them food as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, they'll make money at the same time. Mm-hmm. So this is not a difficult decision. Philadelphia, has something called the Reinvestment Fund. It's based in Philadelphia. They've just announced $22.6 million in financial assistance awards to 134 projects through their 2021 round of America's Healthy Food Financing Initiative Targeted Small Grants Program. This is part of the government. This is part of Tom Vilsack's platform to get smaller companies involved. Of the 134 companies, people that got money, 45% serve rural communities, 81% are owned or led by people of color, women, and or Native people. Of the awardees, 69% are grocery retail projects, 31% offer alternative retail models, including mobile markets, CSAs, and food boxes. So Sally, tell us what some of the award winners were.
I love this, Phil. That's, you know, it's not only getting food to underserved communities, but it is lifting up these companies that are owned by minorities. One of them is the Local Farm Cooperative, which is in Selma, Alabama. Manuel's Food Market, a neighborhood grocer in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Nawoody Denzoni Community General Store in San Carlos, Arizona, and Northeast Grocers is a Black-led neighborhood coalition that is helping people in this area get food. So these are this is a really cool program.
Yeah, I think it's great. And they had over 500 different applications for it. And getting 134 of these companies off and running, it's wonderful. So good for our Ag Secretary. Vilsack is terrific, and continued success with him at our helm. Nature Food, the publication, published research that shows that food miles, the distance between the place where food is grown to our plates, has a much higher carbon footprint than was previously estimated. The carbon cost is actually around 19% of all food-related transportation emissions. That's four times what they originally thought it would be. And if we combine the US, France, Germany, and Japan and crunch those numbers, that represents 12% of the world's population, but about 50% of the emissions associated with food transport. So we really have a significant problem as it relates to it. And what this study says is, Sally, what you and I have been talking about for 20 years, that if you eat local, if you eat what's in season, bottom line is those numbers drop significantly. Trying to buy, you know, strawberries in January that are imported from another country, that really adds to the problem. So maybe finally we can get people to eat local and what's in season. And also, by the way, what's in season means it's got better flavor, it's got more nutrients, and it's less expensive. So all of that, and now we have proof that it's much better for the environment as well. So what, you know, what recommendations are they making that we really need to pay attention to?
Yes, well, they are talking about eating locally and eating seasonally, exactly what you're saying. We have to think about that those higher emissions for fruits and vegetables are largely because they require refrigeration as they're, you know, so there are high costs to this. I, however, feel like just trying to message to consumers, eat locally, eat seasonal foods, isn't going to cut it. And, you know, I don't know about you, Phil. I do know that living in California, that you have access to local fruits and vegetables that do come at a lower cost. But here in Tennessee, where I am, if we go to the farmer's market and buy from local farmers, it's really expensive. And your average person can't afford to do that. You know, so I really feel like the retailers have got to get involved in providing and promoting these seasonal local products for people.
Absolutely. And this research also points out that right now, Your home state of Georgia is cantaloupes, peaches, and zucchini. But in Oregon, it's rhubarb, endives, and apples. So I think this time of year is much better to be in Georgia than in Oregon. They also said that if the entire population of the planet ate locally, the carbon emissions would drop by about a third of a gigaton. That's significant.
Incredible. That's incredible.
And I noticed that you pulled from tastingtable.com a list of meat alternatives, because what they really are saying is if you want to make a big difference, you want to move to more plant-based. We've heard that over and over again. Transportation associated with fruits and vegetables add up to around 36% of the total food mile emissions. That's over a billion tons of carbon dioxide, nearly doubling the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from their production. Meat production emits around 3 billion tons of carbon dioxide, but transportation costs a little over 100 million tons. So as we're going into the summer, barbecue time, burger time, what should people think of as alternatives?
Yes, well, we've been hearing a lot about mushrooms lately, a big trend, and mushrooms are a great ingredient to make up for, you know, you can supplement ground beef with mushrooms so that you're not eating as much beef. Lentils are a great source for this. We can look at seitan and tofu also. Always beans are great. Again, I'm going to call out the food retailers and those retail dietitians that we love working with, you know, to really help consumers learn how to use these substitutes so that they can cut down on their meat.
Absolutely. And the Good Food Institute reports that now there's over 800 brands globally that focus largely on creating plant-based alternatives to meat, dairy, and eggs. Some good news on the horizon. We talked about this a couple months ago, that if in fact the metaverse was going to be as successful as people are proclaiming, there needed to be standards. And now, basically, there's something called the Metaverse Standards Forum, which is open to any organization, no cost. And they're going to focus on pragmatic, action-based projects such as implementation, prototyping, hackathons, plugfests, and open source tooling to accelerate the testing and adoption of metaverse standards while also developing consistent terminology and deployment guidelines. I think this is a huge step forward. But the problem is that Apple is not part of it yet. Hopefully they'll come in. Niantic and Roblox, which are games and virtual worlds, they're not in either. So three of the largest companies are not part of this. And that has me a little concerned. Hopefully they're going to come in. But again, we don't want to get into the situation that we saw with VHS and Beta, for example, that there's standards over here for one and there's standards over here with a different manufacturer, because that's going to slow things down. And there's one retailer, and even though we talk a lot about food, we talk about all retail. There's one retailer who decided to go, you know, full blast into the metaverse. Tell us about that.
Lowe's has decided to jump into the metaverse, and I'm very excited about this. You know, and going back to what you were just talking about the businesses that were on the list, one of them that I noticed was Wayfair. And so that also makes me think about what Lowe's is doing right now, these home goods companies. This is very, very important and innovative. Lowe's is going to be in the metaverse, creating a world where people can go in that are working on designing things for their home, things for your yard, whatever you're doing to update. You can actually go into the metaverse and design your space and get a feel for it. And it seems like a really great idea.
Yeah, I think so. And I haven't gotten in there yet and played around with it, but I will. It's going to include lighting, patio furniture, area rugs, kitchen and bath accessories, decor. I mean, it's going to be everything, digital representation of different home products, furniture. There's no cost to this. And I see two really huge benefits. One is we spoke a couple weeks ago about the problem that Target has with having too many TVs. Well, if we can take the data from people going into the metaverse and see what they're building in their homes, a certain lamp, a certain refrigerator, and so on, this is going to help them plan their purchasing a lot better. So there's that huge benefit that they're going to get out of this, as well as the benefit for us. And also, when you go in, you can then take the furniture or anything else that's there, copy it and put it in your own virtual world. So let's say, you know, you're in a gaming thing or you got an Oculus and you're using one of the rooms. Well, you could bring your own furniture if you want and custom make that whole experience. What research is saying is that by 2026, a quarter of consumers, 25% of us, will spend at least 1 hour per day in the metaverse. That's according to Gartner. Morgan Stanley estimates that the total addressable market for advertising and e-commerce opportunities in the metaverse would be worth $8.3 billion. And here's why Lowe's is involved. $697 billion of that in home and home-related spending. So in my mind, there's no question that we're going to see much more coming out of the metaverse and more companies, you know, getting involved. They should.
Absolutely. And it will be great to see the food world get involved. You know, I think about all of these, the popularity of home goods and home design. It's in television shows that we watch. It's on TikTok, you know, and the same is true for food. And so, you know, as technology is allowing us to do these types of things, you know, as we're watching a TikTok video about a food or a dish that we really like, wouldn't it be cool if we could click into the metaverse, into a space where we can get those products. We can practice cooking that product somehow. There seems like some really great possibilities here.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming up in a few minutes, we're going to show part of my interview with Wesley Rhodes from Kroger, who basically invited me over for an Italian dinner in the metaverse. That he was going to choose all the ingredients, and going to have dinner with Wesley in the metaverse. And now it's time for the Lemper Report. The USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture awarded a four-year, $800,000 grant back in 2006 to Dr. Susan Evans and Dr. Peter Clark at the University of Southern California to figure out how to help those who go to food pantries consume more fruits and vegetables, back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. They developed a tool called QUICK, Help for Meals, a computer system that was provided to food pantries that used message tailoring to create customized booklets of recipes and food use tips individually designed for each household's needs and preferences. While it was very successful, by the time the initial grant ended, the practice of distributing printed information was gone. It was being replaced more and more by digital options like mobile phones. While several food pantries and banks supply supplemental resources to clients, many in collaboration with extension programs at our land-grant universities, Evan and Clark set out to develop a much more tech-savvy approach. What they decided to do is put healthy recipes in the palms of clients' hands through their smart device. Their research showed that 76% of adults whose income is less than $30,000 a year own a smartphone. And for many, that smartphone is their access to the internet. Evans and Clark decided to develop their mobile app that allows users to select the ingredients that, frankly, they've got available at home, create a virtual cookbook of healthy recipes. The idea became a reality with a five-year, $1.3 million AFRR award from NIFA in 2012. Working with pantry clients, chefs, and culinary schools, the team developed VeggieBook, an app with more than 250 vegetable-based recipes, along with nearly 80 secrets to better eating, general tips about more nutritious eating, and strategies for budget-wise food shopping. Innovation with a purpose that is measurable and will make a difference. What they found, frankly, is a lot of people that wanted to eat fruits and vegetables didn't know what to do with them. They solved that problem. Thank you both. Sally, what's hot on job opportunities this week?
Here's something exciting for those wanting to get into the food tech space. The proportion of food manufacturers hiring for machine learning relating positions rose in May, year on year data shows from Global Data Monitors companies in their job postings. They found that 20.9% are recruiting for at least one job that focuses on researching, building, and designing self-running artificial intelligence systems to automate predictive models. The latest figure was higher than the 11.1% of food manufacturers hiring for machine learning related jobs a year ago, and an increase compared to the figure of 18.4% in April. So this is one of the topics that Global Data, which is Just Food's parent company, has identified to be a pretty important disruptive force facing business in the coming years. So companies that excel and invest in these areas now are thought to be better prepared for future businesses. The AI college credential is coveted in the contemporary marketplace, and the job market supply does not come close to matching demand, resulting in six-figure salaries for skilled young people. Now, I looked up some of those colleges that have really great AI programs, and it's Caltech and Carnegie Mellon, Cornell, but these programs are popping up in all kinds of colleges across the country.
Yeah, and it's great advice for anybody in high school or college to get one of those degrees, because as you point out, six figures out of college, not bad, not bad. I think when I graduated college, it was four figures that you
had. Same.
I spoke with Wesley Rhodes, as I mentioned, the chief innovation officer at Kroger, who invited me over for dinner in the metaverse. For the complete interview, just log on to supermarketguru.com and click on Exploring the Retail Metaverse. Here's what he had to say.
So what I'm hearing about the personalization is my experience is going to be different than your experience based on what I'm cooking for dinner tonight or what the products are that I want to look at. What about the other health attributes? So, for example, what we know is there's people who, you know, don't have as good eyesight as other people. In the metaverse, am I going to be able to configure my supermarket to be bigger so I can read the words better? Or if I'm colorblind, you know, be able to change those colors to make it more palatable for me?
Certainly the technology is there to do it. We make larger fonts, smaller fonts. We can eliminate colors, you know, like no red, give me something else in its place. So technologically, that's not hard to do. So if I have a profile that says, I don't see these colors, it's easy to substitute them with the colors that I want instead of that color. So I know this color is really represented in another, so that I understand exactly what I'm seeing and how large do I want these things. You bet.
On today's Bullseye, we ask the question once again, can food taxes and subsidies help us eat more healthy? This time with the help of researchers from the University of Connecticut and the University of Illinois, who were recruited by the World Health Organization. There are precedents that have been successful. Taxes on tobacco and alcohol, for example. Around the globe, there are other success stories, as in Mexico, where there's a 1 peso per liter tax on sugar-sweetened drinks. And over the past 3 years, we've seen the results. The probability of being a non-consumer of soft drinks has increased by 4.7%. Probability of being a medium or high consumer of these beverages decreased by 6.8% and 6.1% respectively. So what did these researchers find? Well, in the first paper that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they actually reviewed 54 articles globally, of which 15 studies were included in their meta-analysis. The result was that fruit and vegetable subsidies, like doubling the value when people are using their SNAP benefits, were associated with just a moderate increase in fruit and vegetable sales. A surprise. In the second paper, also published in JAMA, they focused on the outcome of taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. They reviewed 86 studies from around the world with a meta-analysis of 62 of them and found that indeed these taxes increased prices and reduced sales for these type of drinks. More than 45 countries and several local jurisdictions, they report, have implemented sugar-sweetened beverage taxes with the intention to improve nutrition and population health. The researchers also found that these taxes have prompted many of the brands producing these drinks to reformulate, to reduce their sugar content. They also pointed out that the study does have limitations, and further studies should be conducted in order to understand the association with diet and health outcomes, as well as assessing the viability and the variability of consumer populations by demography, which will improve policy reach and effectiveness. Taxes work. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget, visit supermarketguru.com for our archives if you missed anything on today's episode, as well as any of our episodes that are, you know, over the past 7, 8, 9 months. Check it out at supermarketguru.com. And we will meet here again, same time, same place, next week.